Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 5, entitled The Demigod's Appeal to the Lord, Text 34. So mamano yasya sama manante. So mamano yasya sama manante. Devakasam yo balam anda ayu. Devakasam yo balam anda ayu. Isho naganam prajana prajanam. Isho naganam prajana prajanam. Prasidatam na samahavibhuti. So mam mano yasya saman mananti. Div ak asam yo balam anda ayu. Isho naganam prajana prajanam. Prasidatam na samaha vibhuti. Bolo. Soma, the moon, is the source of all food grains, strength and longevity of all the demigods. He is also the master of all vegetation and the source of generation for all living entities. As stated by learned scholars, the moon is the mind of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. May that Supreme Personality of Godhead, the source of all offerings, be pleased with us. Purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Soma, the predominating deity of the moon, is the source of food grains and therefore the source of strength, even for the celestial beings, the demigods. He is the vital force of all vegetation. Unfortunately, modern so-called scientists do not fully understand the moon, describe the moon as being full of deserts. Since the moon is the source of our vegetation, how can the moon be a desert? The moonshine is a vital force of all vegetation, and therefore we cannot possibly accept that the moon is a desert. So here, 8th canto of Bhagavatam, chapter is entitled The Demigod's Appeal to the Lord. Here's describing something about the moon. And of course in the West we're not in the West now, but I spend a lot of my time in the West. We don't have a conception that there's a personality behind the moon. So here's described the moon god. And Prabhupada makes the point that the moon itself is not a desert. Of course, modern day so-called, as Prabhupada puts in the purport nicely, so-called scientists proclaim that the moon is just sand. So here, one of the main... Actually, Srila Prabhupada said there was, I can't remember, but it was two things that he came to this world to deliver us. One was to print his books, and the other one was to smash the materialistic scientists. So we see that Prabhupada was very keen in every page of Bhagavatam, practically, to defeat the materialistic scientists. And I was just reading Prabhupada's letters. And one of the last letters he wrote in 1977 was to Rameshwar Prabhu, encouraging him to fund Bhaktivedanta Institute. He mentioned a figure of at least $10,000 a month. So in that way, he very much wanted this, the so-called scientists to be smashed. So I thought we'd try something a little different today, as you hear Bhagavatam class every morning, and this is going to be Bhagavatam class, I hope. But there's a nice group of scientists that have looked at this question of evolution and have come up with a nice theory that there's a personality, there's an intelligent force behind creation, which is very much contradictory to the majority of modern day scientists who proclaim that everything comes from evolution, from some chemical evolution and ultimately some Darwinistic theory. So everyone here, anyone here familiar with intelligent design? Stick your hand up if you're familiar. So anyway, that's only four. Good, I can explain something. So so this theory that, of course, Charles Darwin in 1859 wrote his Origin of the Species to explain that everything comes, that species evolve from different, evolve through natural selection, through small stages they develop in what's called functional advantages, so that the species develop, because if they develop in a particular way, then they will, their environment, they will improve their function in that environment. And the finch is used, there's many different types of finches in the Galapagos Islands, which he visited, six different types of finches. So they had different beaks. So the finches with the large beak, they tended to be able to get to the food source easier, because the larger beak would facilitate them. If they missed a season, they could crack open the old seeds and eat them. So then the finch population with the larger beak generally lasted longer. So this works very well in a particular framework. But what it doesn't explain is the source of the species. It talks about how a species may develop within a small environment. There's different types of development. There's microgenetics and macrogenetics. So microgenetics is where a species can change within its own species to adapt. But macrogenetics is when a species changes from one species to another. So it works very well within the microgenetics, but within the larger scale genetics, the macrogenetics, it doesn't work. So this functional advantage, or this small steps, is the basic understanding of Darwinism. So unfortunately, it doesn't explain anything or look at all at the source of the world. So obviously the argument between the theist and the atheist is the theist believes there's an intelligent source, and the atheist believes all happened by chance. So this intelligent design theory has been put together by a group of Christian scientists, basically, and they put forward that behind everything there's intelligence. And they put forward many very good examples. There's a Dr. Behe, who is a biologist. So basically, they discovered that if you look closer and closer into the cell, and you look at what's functioning within the cell, then it's such an amazing arrangement that goes on, the DNA, the RNA. And they focus on one particular element called the flagella, which is a particular motorized, like an outboard motor that runs around in the cell and moves energy sources and helps the cell in its maintenance. So this is a 40-part instrument. It has 40 separate parts. It has a sensory blade that goes around. It has an outboard motor, and it has so many functions. So these 40 parts have to come together in exactly a perfect sync. Otherwise, if you bring in 40 parts from, like when you build a house, if you build a house, you build the foundations first, then you build the walls, and then you put the plumbing in. Everything has to be in sync. So this flagella motor has 40 parts. It has to be in a synchronized way, otherwise it doesn't work. If there's 39 parts, 38 parts, 37 parts, it doesn't work. Not only that, it has to be built and constructed in a particular way. So this brings up the concept of what they call irreducible complexity. If you reduce the complexity even one tiny bit, then it doesn't work. So for that to have happened by chance, these 40 parts to come together in this particular way and work, is actually beyond the realms of possibility. So when you, for instance, the examples used we hear a lot when we attend Bhagavatam class, if there's a large explosion, for instance, this building here that we're in is very complicated. There's so many bricks, so many electrical wires, so much plumbing. So if we were to put, we get some space, some parking lot, some parking area, and we put a bomb in it, and we put loads of debris in, we put the beams in, we put the, steel beams, and we put it all together, and we put the wallpaper in, and we put the gold leaf in, all in a pile, put all the ingredients that are needed to build a beautiful temple like this, we put it all together in one big pile, and then we explode it. This is their theory, as we all know, that over millions and millions of years, if you were just to explode it over and over and over and over again, eventually you get a temple like this. This is actually their theory. So there's one fictitious company called Blow It Up Construction that will provide, you just have to find some empty space, throw all the ingredients, and they just keep blowing it up until you get your house, the house you want, with the wallpaper you want, with the windows you want, with everything you want. So it's completely ridiculous. But of course, probably 99% of the population believe in this theory, that everything just exploded into existence. Of course, the other question is, where did the explosion come from? If you walk down the street and there was a big explosion to your left, and a whole building was... In fact, here in Bombay, you had that big explosion a year ago or so, right, with the hotels. So when that explosion happened in Bombay, did everyone just go, oh, it happened by chance? It just happened. No, the police were in there, the paramilitary were in there, the medics were in there, everyone was in there, because nothing, it doesn't happen by chance. An explosion doesn't happen by chance. So everyone sees that actually, if there is an explosion, let's say, for instance, it was a big bang, and by millions and millions and millions and millions of years and exploded millions and millions of times, it created the universe, which is much complicated than one building. But where did the explosion come from? They never even look at this. And this is another thing that Darwin doesn't do. He never looks at the origin. The name of his book is Origin of the Species, but he doesn't actually look at the origin. He looks at what we've got now and explains how it may have evolved. So this theory is... it's completely wrong, but it's completely ridiculous at the same time. So they analyze this flagella, which is in the cell, with its 40 parts. It runs around, and it has irreducible complexity. You reduce it in any way, it doesn't work. So this small stages, as Darwin put it, of every stage being a functional advantage, eventually you get, for instance, the eye is a very complicated mechanism. So the idea within Darwinism is that you have a glob, and that glob has a functional advantage and changes slightly, and then it has another functional advantage and changes slightly, and then it has another functional. It's because for a glob to turn into an eye, you're talking about millions of small changes, because it's a very complicated piece of apparatus. So where's the functional advantage until you get the focusing eye? There isn't any. There's none. There is no functional advantage until you get the operating eye. So how is that possible? It's not. So in the same way, this flagella that works, and the RNA, the DNA, everything works so perfectly, there's no possibility that there's some small stages to that functional advantage. So they very nicely look at this theory, and they explain that, for instance, in Mount Rushmore, we have any Americans here? No. Anyone been to Mount Rushmore? Anyone heard of Mount Rushmore? Yeah. One or two. So on Mount Rushmore, the five presidents of America have been carved by some insane, well, semi-insane person who spent the best part of his life chiseling out these huge, the size of this ceiling, faces of these five presidents. So this... these chiselings, these sculptures, have not happened by chance. They've not arrived by random selection. They haven't been worn away by the wind and the rain. It shows some intelligent design. Someone has got up there. And no one will argue that someone went up there and carved them. No one, not one person on the planet, unless they're in a lunatic asylum, of course. But no one's going to argue that those five faces were carved. Because that by that design, there's no possibility that could have happened by chance. So similarly, we look at the material world that we're living in, or the materialists, the so-called scientists, look at this material world, and they try and say there's no intelligence behind it. There's no person behind it. So people are covered by envy. They can't accept there's a supreme being, and what to speak of serving him, worshipping him, following his directions. In fact, I was flying over just 2 days ago from London, and there was a group of Raj Yogi practitioners. I don't think they really were practitioners. At least they called themselves Raj Yogi practitioners. And I was sitting next to her, and we were arguing the point about a supreme being. So she said everything was from light. And there's an almighty, but that almighty doesn't have a form. And that Krishna is just a material representation of that light. So we went through so many arguments, and we spoke for about an hour and a half. And then she said, it says in Bhagavad Gita, this, this, and this. And I said, oh, where does it say in Bhagavad Gita, this, and this? Because I'm white, then I shouldn't know I was a devotee. She knew I was into spiritual life. So I said, oh, where does it say in Bhagavad Gita? And she said, well, I don't know the exact verse. I said, well, anywhere, where does it say? In fact, what are the words used? What are the Sanskrit? What are the English words used? She said, well, so then she didn't really have any, she couldn't quote anything from Bhagavad Gita, not one verse, not one sloka, nothing, no Sanskrit, no English, nothing, no Hindi, no anything. But then she was concluding from Bhagavad Gita that this was the case. So we made the point that, you know, how can you conclude a scripture that you don't know anything about? But she was saying everything was coming from a divine light, a bright light. So we explained, you know, Brahma, Meti, Pramma, Meti, Bhagavaniti, Subjate, that is an aspect of the Supreme. But because she's been hurt so much in her life, that to be able to conceive as a person, that she has a personal relationship, is so painful for her that she couldn't accept. In fact, in Bhagavad Gita it describes... if anyone knows the exact English, then let me know. When a person has, they have a fear of their own personal identity, and that is due to pain in their life. People have suffered so much pain that they can't bear the thought that they're eternally a person. Because eternal person means eternal pain, because they've experienced so much pain in their lives. And we see in Kali Yuga, so many people are traumatized by so many different childhood experiences, so much child abuse, so much, you know, neglect, which is also abuse, so much unloved situations. They become so traumatized and they become so disturbed and they have so much pain in their lives. To accept a personal identity is actually very, very difficult for them. So if God's a person and they're a person and they have a personal relationship with God, If my whole experience in life is so painful, then God's only going to cast his, you know, thunderbolts from the heavens and zap me every few minutes for thinking the wrong thing. So if there's a God, then... So this is a misunderstanding due to pain. But if people can understand that God is the supreme personality of love, of kindness, of friendship, of intelligence, of beauty, of strength, then immediately, oh... It's like everyone wants to be friendly with Obama. Everyone's heard of Obama? Or Mr. Singh? Is it Mr. Singh still here in India as a prime minister? Everyone would be very happy. Oh, Mr. Singh and I are very close friends. Oh, Obama and I are very close. We'd be very pleased. So God is the supreme prime minister, president. Is it prime minister or president here? Prime minister. Yeah, same as England. So then if everyone's happy to be so close to these famous, powerful personalities, what to speak of being so happy to Krishna, the reservoir of all strength, beauty, love? So this pain that they have experienced is the cause of them neglecting or negating, trying to negate their personal lives. So because of this, they're covered by pain, covered by envy, covered by so many problems. So they find it very difficult. And if you analyze a lot of the so-called scientists, they've also, due to envy, due to hurt, they try and negate the possibility of a God. In fact, there's one nice example, and they call it, they have these huge long words for these very simple concepts, just to confuse everyone. And one is called punctuated equilibrium, which is an idea where when fossils are found in particular strata that's much older than it should be, then they try and reconcile that by saying that there was this punctuated equilibrium where something happened very quickly over a very short period of time, and that's why it's in such old rock. So they have whatever formula they try and create to avoid the possibility that there's a God. But real science, of course, is to science, it means to research, to have a hypothesis, to research and have a conclusion. That's science. So the hypothesis, there is a God, or the hypothesis is there isn't a God. And then the research is made, and then the conclusion is found. But of course, what they do, as described by Sadaputta Bharu and the other devotee, I've forgotten his name, this knowledge filter, whatever comes within their realm of their theory, they accept as information. And anything contradicts their theory, they reject. Just like that book, Forbidden Archaeology, so many archaeological finds have been found that directly go against general modern-day Darwinism, but they exclude it from their findings because it doesn't agree with their train of thought. So they'll try and find so many different avenues to explore which are atheistic. So we have to analyze within our own life how we also do this. We try and not accept the four regular principles. We try and not accept the holy name of the Lord. We try not to accept the Guru. We try not to read Prabhupada's books. All these tendencies are the same. You know, we've been hurt. We have some envy of God. So in that way, we have no taste for engaging in these activities. So we have to look within our own hearts and mind and say, how do I overcome these anathas? This anatha nivritti stage is actually impersonalism, envy. So we accept, we have to see. Just like a person may be driven to perform a bad activity because they have a desire to do that. But if they become aware of their desire, then they can make a conscious decision whether to do it or not do it. Just like someone who's drinking, he's had a habit of drinking. So all his life he's been drinking. So at one point something happens in his life and he's thinking, why am I doing this to myself? And the reason they're doing these activities a lot of the time is because they're not aware how detrimental they are to their health, to their well-being. So when we become more aware of our own personal attachments and anathas, then we can give it up. In fact, in Bhagavad Gita, Karma Esha Krodha Esha, Prabhupada mentions in that purport that if you know your enemy in this material world in different forms is lust, Karma Esha Krodha Esha, Rajaguna Sambhava. So if Prabhupada mentions in the purport that if we can identify this enemy, then we can fight it. You can't find an enemy if you don't know where it's coming from. Sometimes you see these films and the enemy is invisible. So how do you fight? Shalva, wasn't it? He became invisible in different situations. So how can you fight someone that's invisible? So you have to know your enemy. So to some degree we have to know our enemies within